Blog Talk Radio.
It's Sunday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, and therefore the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and a list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, then links to my series, The Newspaper Columns. Upcoming episodes of the show will include authors, poets, academics, judges, technologists, attorneys, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope that you will too. My guest next week is poet and prose writer, a literary consultant and teacher, Amy Hope Holman. Then now on with tonight's show. My guest tonight, Stan Probelsky, another native New Yorker, is the graduate of Columbia University and the Brooklyn School of Law. Prior to becoming a lawyer, Stan was a newspaper reporter, bartender, and a college administrator. As a lawyer, Stan was a felony trial prosecutor in the Brooklyn DA's office and the New York City-wide office of the Special Prosecutor for Narcotics and Guns, as well as a civil trial attorney for the New York City Department of Education. He is more recently the author of four crime novels and numerous short stories. He also maintains the very lively and strongly opinionated blog, after all he is a New Yorker, that's called the Mean Streets Blog. Now let's meet Stan and try to understand how he could have crammed so much into his life. Good evening, Stan, and welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening to you, John. I'm glad to be here.
Let's go back to the beginning. I mentioned in the intro you're a New Yorker. Where'd you grow up and go to grammar in high school?
Oh, wow. Now you're talking geography. John, I went to grammar school in Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, North Carolina, Florida, and junior high school on Long Island. And high school on Long Island. How's that for a little background?
That's a background. I know that you went to Columbia and to Brooklyn Law School, but you're also a bartender, newspaper reporter, and a college administrator. I'm confused by which came when. Would you take us through the chronology?
Sure. I happened to be working for Newsweek back in the late 60s, early 70s. And at that time, I was also writing sports for the now-defunct Long Island Press, but I also had a job working four nights a week as a bartender at the English Pub in Greenwich Village. And it was much later that I went to Columbia. You know, the United States is the land of second and third chances, and I took mine. Columbia gave it to me, and I went there. And after I graduated, I was lucky enough to land a job as an administrator.
And where were you an administrator?
At the School of Journalism and at the School of Mines in the School of Engineering. That's Mines, M-I-N-E-S. And then later I was the program officer for the Center for Chinese Legal Studies in the law school.
And what led you to law school from that background?
Oh, that goes back to my days as a criminal justice reporter for the Long Island Press, covering the courts in Queens and Brooklyn. This was something I had in my mind for years and years and years. And, you know, like push came to shove, I said, I better do it now or I'll never do it. And so I went and did it. Went to law school and then took a position as an ADA in the Kings County District Attorney's Office.
Yeah, as the lawyer, you were the felony prosecutor there and also the New York Citywide Office of the Special Prosecutor. That sounded like both interesting work and fodder for your later novels. Would you take us through some of your experiences as a prosecutor?
Sure. I can tell you I did both felony trial prosecution and I did appellate work. But to be honest with you, one of the most interesting jobs I had, John, was when I was what they called the DTAP liaison. And that was, DTAP stands for Drug Treatment Alternative to Prison. And my job was to take addicts who had been arrested for felony narcotics sale and were offered the opportunity to forego going to prison for lengthy long-term in-house treatment, let's say at Odyssey House, places like that, and defer their prosecution. If they graduated, if they made it through the 3 years in-house, their guilty plea would be expunged. If not, then we went to trial, and then all the time they wasted trying to get clean was to not, as they would wind up going to prison afterwards. But we found and still find today that these sort of programs save both the city and the state millions upon millions of dollars and deferred incarceration costs.
They must also help to straighten out some of the addicts. Also.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a combination not just of physical treatment, but long-term psychiatric treatment. I found virtually everybody I worked with had serious psychological problems, much of it to do with the disturbed childhoods. And so not that everybody succeeded. There were people that would abscond or would not return from weekend passes. There was one unfortunate incident where a fellow was only three months away from graduating, and he broke and didn't return and wound up doing 5 years in prison after doing 2 years and 7 months of in-house treatment.
That's sad. You were also a civil trial attorney for New York's City Department of Education, involved in the trying of teachers and other employees in disciplinary actions. Did this involve inappropriate sexual acts by teachers as well as other malfeasance?
Yes, certainly, yes. There were several incidents of sexual male conduct, but there's other kinds. I had one teacher that was tried who had falsified claims for reimbursement for jury duty when she had actually been in jail at the time.
What was she in jail for?
drug possession and disorderly conduct.
Now, would any drug possession violate the teacher's contract? Would they go out for anything like that anyhow, even if he hadn't lied about jury duty?
Well, yes, because you know, teachers are expected to abide by a certain standard of conduct, and in this case, this particular teacher had repeated arrests for loitering and disorderly conduct in drug locations, and you know, sooner or later, she was going to go. It was just a question of the system catching up to misdemeanor arrests. she had been suspended without pay, and the system just had to take its process. It's a lengthy process, unfortunately. It's a system that works under the New York State education law, and it has built-in safeguards for the teacher as much as there are for police officers and firefighters who obtain these extra safeguards in return for giving up the right to strike.
That sounds like it would have been much more depressing work than trying to turn addicts' lives around. Did it get to you, seeing people that we expect to behave in an exemplary manner for our school children behave like that?
Actually not, John, because I found it as satisfying as turning people's lives around, getting rid of the slugs and the and the miscreants out of the school system. I mean, okay. I felt I was doing a service to the children and parents of the city.
You and I first met in person when I moderated the panel of authors and poets at a book fair at Coogan's terrific restaurant in Washington Heights in 2012. By the way, I hope to get Peter Walsh, one of Coogan's owners, on the show in the near future. I imagine that you began writing during your attorney years. What led you down that path, and how long did it take to become a full-time career?
Actually, I didn't really start writing in depth, fiction writing, that is, until I left the Department of Education. But I had in my mind that as soon as I left, the next day I would start writing, and that's what I did. The first novel took me 2 years to complete. Well, from that point.
Now, what led you in that direction? You said you had it in mind. Why did you think you'd like it and be successful at it?
Well, it's not even a question of success. If you plan to write because you think you're going to be a success, do yourself a favor and turn on the TV. I don't know, I wrote because I had to write, and there was something inside me that just wanted me to write for whatever psychological reasons. Hemingway once wrote in one of his stories in Fathers and Sons, a Nick Adams story, where Nick, a semi-autobiographical story where Nick says he would sit down and write it out and get rid of it like he always had, and I think to myself that's quite similar. By writing, I'm getting rid of things. What they are, I may not know, but I'm just doing it.
I agree totally. And one of the lines, and I'm not sure if it's from Sharon Olds, it's from another writer, is it's very hard to write, but it's much harder not to write, which I like.
I like that, too, and it certainly is for me, because when I'm not writing short stories, writing novels, I'm writing short stories, and when I'm not doing that, I'm blogging. When I'm not blogging, I'm writing letters to the editor.
Yeah, I've recently had some letters to the editor, and I also write nonfiction, a weekly column, as well as a novel and some poetry. In addition to the four crime novels, you've published a number of short stories, as you mentioned, in such venues as Hardball Magazine, Sherlock Holmes Mystery Magazine, as well as the Sherlock Holmes and boxing anthologies. I've always found short stories the most difficult writing discipline, as you must set the environment to find the characters and tell a story all in a very concise manner. Do you find it that way, or does the style come easy to you?
I did. At first, I found it much more difficult, but then now I actually find it easier. Once I sit down, I just find it more difficult to find myself excited about sitting down to write a short story as I am a novel. But once I do it, I seem to be able to bang it out a lot easier. Perhaps that goes back to my days of newspapering, when I had to work on deadline a lot. Perhaps it has to do with the influences on me. I seem to, once I get the germ on my mind, the bug, I seem to be able to sit down and do it with facility.
Moving into some lyric criticism, in one of your notes to me, you mentioned that you'd like to discuss the literary hero in the modern world. If I remember correctly, you broke your analysis into three distinct categories, the Hemingway hero, the noir protagonist, and the modern anti-hero. Why don't you go into it? I'll interrupt you with questions if they come up.
Well, this is quite interesting because, you know, we're approaching now the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War. And, of course, Hemingway had his own hero, and that hero happened to be a great American president by the name of Teddy Roosevelt, who had developed his own creed of life in that, young men were to be, you know, unflinching in the face of danger and, to swallow their fear and to not be a prig, not be a rat, to try to stay in good physical shape, and he really pushed the outdoors. And Hemingway, to a large part, developed that as his own personal creed, and he shaped that. His heroes seemed to shape that, or he put them into his own heroes. And he tried to make them live as he lived, you know, to overcome whatever faults they have, you know, to face danger bravely and then to die for a good cause. Even in the Second World War and the post-war, there's still hung that aura of doing one's duty. Ironically, it's not just in the United States, but in Britain. John Le Carré, in his hero, which is not George Smiley, by the way, in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, to me it's Jim Prideaux, who also exemplified the Hemingway hero, who was going into Czechoslovakia on a mission that he knew that he would liably be captured or killed. He's asked, "Why did you do it?" And he said simply, "Because control asked me." It's called doing one's duty. Now today, the anti-hero is somewhat different. He marches to his own drummer, and you see that in my good friend Ken Bruin out in Galway, Ireland, who writes he's on his 10th book now of the Jack Taylor series. Who is the ultimate anti-hero, Jack Taylor, the down and out two-fisted finder. They don't have private eyes, and they don't have private eyes in Ireland because they're too much like informers. But Jack works as a finder, and he's never too far from a shot of Jameson and a pint of Guinness. He manages through all his induced phases to get the job done.
Closer to home, both Lawrence Block and Max Allen Collins have heroes that are hitmen in Keller and other things like that. Do you include them in the anti-hero?
Yeah, they're certainly not protagonists in the true sense. They're a true noir hero. They're not your upstanding, upright guy, you know. And also, we progressed somewhat. That's interesting because as Lawrence Block has done, we progressed beyond the noir heroes of the 40s and 50s, where the guys were basically losers. And they were either down and out, or they were schlumps that couldn't do anything right, and found themselves trapped in situations beyond their control. Today our anti-heroes are much more powerful. And perhaps to a large degree that reflects our society. And that we realize now that there are literally people walking around who get away with murder.
Yeah, the Block's main hero is a recovering alcoholic who was pushed off the police force after drunkenness caused a death. But he's he writes very well, I think, by the way. Who else would you mention as Dinah Watt protagonist? Would that be Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler type of heroes?
David Goodis. I don't know if you're familiar with David Goodis at all, but to me he's the ultimate noir anti-hero author.
Okay.
Just let me just think of a couple of his. Humphrey Bogart actually did a couple of his stories into movies, but they sort of had to clean it up and make the guy and make the guy better than he was. There's the one where Bogey plays the protagonist that gets his face redone. Escape from San Quentin.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, in the written story by Goodis, he actually throws the woman at the end. He throws the woman that had testified against him at trial. He throws her out of a window. They changed that in the movie, but that was sort of a cool story. God, I can't remember the name of it. Let me just think for one second. Hold on.
Well, in the old days, movies had to end that way. I remember the play. The Bad Seed on Broadway, that little girl who was the devil and she actually killed her mother, she got killed by lightning, whereas in the movie, but in the play, she survived and she was playing up to her father. I'll take care of you, Daddy. I'll take care of you, you know. So the movies had to have a different ending at that time.
Yeah. Another one that was good was a terrific writer. It was a female writer, and they had very few noir female writers. And Dorothy B. Hughes, she wrote In a Lonely Place, and that was also made into a movie with Bogey. And although again they cleaned up the male protagonist there somewhat because it was really raw. But these are books still well worth reading today.
Now, do you see any of these writers as strong influences on you, or do you associate with them in your writing?
To be honest with you, my influences are far from eclectic. They actually go to a very 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 select bunch. And it has to do with the mindset of their protagonist and their sense of humor. And I have to say, except for Hemingway, who has influenced me greatly on short story writing, my novel influences are almost all British. There's John le Carré, Frederick Forsyth, Another writer called Adam Hall, who's rarely read today, but he wrote the Quiller series.
The Quiller series, sure.
Right, Quiller Memorandum with a bunch of sequelae, maybe 30 novels, and Len Deighton. As a matter of fact, the reason I wouldn't say it's the only reason, but one of the reasons I was admitted into college was the dean of admissions had read in my application that I like to read books by Len Deighton, and he called me in for an interview because he said I was the first applicant he had ever come across that had read Len Deighton, and he loved Len Deighton.
My original favorite mystery writer was Leslie Charteris, the Saint author, who was also British. Len Deighton was interesting. I forget who played Quiller. Famous actor played him in the movies.
Wasn't it George Segal?
I I didn't think so. I thought it was I'll come back to it. Turning to nonfiction, I just read two very hard-hitting pieces by you. The first was your comment on Governor Christie and the Digita Bridgegate. Please give the audience your take on the ongoing story.
Oh, this is just getting started. It's getting started. Just remember the old saying: the fish rots from the head, and people are going to find it very hard to believe, as I do already, that that these people are around Christie in his office, and already now they've got at least 10 linked. 10 linked by emails if not the original snarling of the lanes onto the bridge, but of the subsequent cover-up. Nobody's going to believe that all of these people acted on their own, or if they did act on their own, they surely must have been the culture of that office. My take is. It doesn't matter whether he actually gave the orders or not. This is the way he ran his office, and this is the mentality that they had, and it's just terrible. Now Steve Kornacki today came up with a new wrinkle. Apparently there's 16 acres of prime commercial property sitting right next to the entrance to the George Washington Bridge that the mayor of Fort Lee has been trying for years to get developed, and it's finally been ready for $1 billion development. And exactly at the same time that this bridge, that these lane closings were put into effect, there was supposed to be a meeting between the developers and banks to finalize the lending for this project. And one of the main selling points of this project was the access onto the George Washington Bridge through those lanes. So I don't know. Maybe somebody had an axe to grind. Maybe somebody didn't want to develop. Maybe somebody wanted to force a sale to them. Who knows? This is Jersey we're talking about.
But Rachel Maddow came up with another theory that was picked up by the newspapers, that it was really aimed not so much at the mayor, but at the representative in the legislature that blocked one of his appointees. He called it an animal, actually, in the press, and she thinks it was aimed at her. The New York Post had a story yesterday that 51% of New Jerseyans believed that he knew, and over 50% said that if he did know, he should resign. So it's apparently really picking up of steam against his administration.
Yeah, well, we'll find out later on this upcoming week, because the new term starts for the New Jersey Assembly and State Senate. So they can only issue the subpoenas once the new Senate is sworn in. Once that happens, there's going to be a big round of subpoenas going out to all his office staffers, and so we'll see what happens then. But
go ahead.
I was going to say that we've already gotten one smoking gun, and it looks like there's two more in the material that was released yesterday.
Even a stronger piece than the Christie one, in my judgment, was a November 9th posting in your extremely interesting Mean Streets blog. The piece, Scandal Meets Morning Joe, Dirty Little Secrets Always Come Out, involved the death of the female intern to work in then Congressman Joe Scarborough's office, and it both intimates that there was a cover up in the circumstance surrounding a death, and casts doubts on the official story surrounding Scarborough's resignation from office. Would you go into the story for us, because I haven't seen that anyplace else?
Well, without mentioning the young lady's name, which I don't want to do. If somebody wants to know who she is, let them go research so they can find out. It happened in his Florida office. This young lady, the staffer that worked for him, was found dead. The circumstances were very murky. No autopsy was ever done. Apparently, the certification of her death was done by a medical examiner who had ties to the local politicians and who subsequently was fired for botching other autopsies. It turned out that she had suffered repeated blows to the head. She was no toxicology report was ever done. It was all very bizarre, and what happened was that, without going into Scarborough's past in his own personal life, let's just say that he was well known as a womanizer in the area, and he happened to like young women, and. And when the state Republican Party got wind of the problems, apparently he was advised by the state Republican Party not to seek re-election. But no investigation was ever done into this woman's death by the local police, and as I said, no real autopsy was ever done, and the. The doctor that certified her death was subsequently suspended and then fired for botching other autopsies.
Now, you mentioned in the post that on the blog that the official reason for his resignation from Congress was that he had said he wanted to spend more time with his family, but you pointed out he was in the process of being divorced at the time.
Right, and moving to New York. It's pretty tough to spend more time with your family in Florida when you're moving to New York.
I remember when Ted Kennedy passed away, though. Scarborough said that even though that he disagreed with Kennedy politically, that he could never say a bad thing about him because when he was leaving Congress, and apparently the story was because of an illness to his son, that Kennedy called him and said, if you ever need anything, I've been through this with my son. Remember, Kennedy's son lost his leg. He said, anything you want, just call me up. And then Scarborough spoke very movingly about Kennedy. So apparently the story that was out was that he had an ill child, and that was why he was resigning. So.
Well, that may have been the story. What can I say? I mean, it's all murky. I mean, that's why they have people that are like Olivia Pope on Scandal. I mean,
now has there been any comment from Scarborough or from his office? Have you got in touch with them?
No. Not for me to reach out to him. I'm just making a comparison to a real life story to a fictional scenario, by the way, which is up for Golden Globe Awards tonight. Scandal.
Do you like that? Do you like that show? I think
it's
terrific.
I think it's terrific too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really admire Joe Morton, who plays Olivia Pope's father, Ike Pope.
He's
a Long Island guy.
You also said you had some strong feelings, and if I bring it up, that you'll talk forever about the Snowden case. What are your feelings there?
Well, I think at this point the ball is in Vladimir Putin's corner, and he probably could do us all a favor by appointing Snowden as a special envoy to Dagestan, and he could send him down there and let him do house-to-house surveys in Dagestan to see how the people there feel about the Russian Republic.
Well, he's initially, obviously, all of the wolves were out, and they were talking treason. Now with the reaction against the NSA surveillance, the tide seems to have turned somewhat in public opinion.
Well, I don't know what reaction you're talking about. I think if you talk to most people in the country, you'll find the majority, I won't say vast majority, but you'll find the majority of the people are pretty much in accord with what the NSA is doing. I wouldn't call Snowden a traitor. He's certainly a coward and a criminal, but to go as far as saying a traitor, no, that's something for the courts to decide.
I had a former federal prosecutor on for talking about computer crime. That was his role at the Department of Justice. He headed up the Computer Crime Task Force, and his feeling is that he's the information gathering that the agencies have been doing, but he said the problem is that there was never any public debate on it, and in many ways they can't because they mentioned it's classified. But for instance, that recently came out that the FBI has been sponsoring a program that you may have come across called Day Zero, and what Day Zero is when Microsoft or Apple or someone releases a new operating system or the new product. There's often bugs in the system that they don't know about. Well, apparently the FBI has been paying contractors to look for these bugs. And when they find the bugs, they reveal them to the FBI. So if the FBI wanted to get into your computer for whatever reason, and apparently they have warrants to do so, that they're able to get in and they're able to do things like turn on the recorder, turn on the camera, examine your files. And the problem that was brought up is that pedophiles and terrorists don't have special computers. And if there's a bug in an operating system, it's the kind of thing that not only criminals might be using, but identity thieves, terrorists, anybody, China, and that by not telling Microsoft, Apple, whoever, about the bugs, it could be corrected, that this policy is putting us all at jeopardy. Does that make any sense to you?
We'd be in jeopardy if they didn't do this program. We'd be in jeopardy, correct? Because the bugs are still there. They're not running a public service program to find bugs, to do the work for Microsoft and the other people. They're there to find bugs for national security purposes.
Well, for criminal prosecution purposes. The other concern that the prosecutor has is Department of Justice will be following their guidelines for warrants and for other things, that there was the fear that as it starts to move down that technology to local departments, other things, there might not be the constitutional protections for the.
Well, here in New York, the protections are even greater. It's extremely difficult, to get a warrant for a wiretap or for computer intrusion. You really have to jump through hoops. Judges are very loath to do that, unless there are exigent circumstances.
I agree. I've done some consulting years ago for New York State Police in a computer area, and I had some interesting things about that they learned as they went along. For instance, there was a fellow who they found had been hitting various places, he'd been breaking into them, and to make free phone calls and everything. And he had an apartment in Inwood, the neighborhood I grew up in. And the police arrested him. But they did not find him doing it. And he said, he doesn't know what you're talking about. He said, it's probably the people who, that they said, well, we have your computer and these calls were made from here. And he said, well, it's probably the people who come into the house. He said, people come in to use the phone. He said, well, who are the people? He says, I don't know. It's just a pretty tough neighborhood. And when a guy says, I want to use your computer, you let him. And the defense worked. They also learned that you can't arrest a computer, that you have to arrest someone doing things on a computer. So it was an educational process in the early days.
Yeah.
Your novels have been set not only in the United States, but in foreign countries. Would you go into some of the plots for us?
Oh, sure. In the Gendarme, which was my first novel, the plot starts out with a bombing of a precinct station house in Brooklyn. And the mayor at that time, who was New York City's mayor, who was a powerful and wealthy individual, decided he was going to finance his own expedition to get the person responsible brought back to the United States, you know, or if not brought back, eliminated. And they happened to use this one detective by the name who remained nameless, who only had a code name in the novel, to go over there. And the action took him from Paris to Bosnia, to Marseille. And needless to say, it had a very true ring to it. The research, I did a lot of research on it. It was based upon research that was done by a very interesting fellow by the name of Evan Coleman, who's one of the premier analysts of foreign terrorists abroad, and he's also now a contributor to NBC. But Evan had done very in-depth research on the forerunners at that time, forerunners of the Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb, on their activities in France, in metropolitan France itself, and I used that as the basis for my novel. The next three novels were all in the Doherty series, and they all involved Doherty, who's an attorney for the New York City Department of Education, and the various plots. In The Ides of June, it involved solving the 30-year-old murder of a retiring school principal's twin sister. In 40 Deuce, it involved the retrieving of a missing 14-year-old girl who was going to be a witness in the department trial of a teacher who was accused of molesting one of the girl's classmates. And in One Trick Pony, it involved Doherty being hired by a federal judge here in New York to find her daughter, who was a Columbia student who was studying in Paris and had disappeared and may have been kidnapped. They're, you know, same protagonist but very very different plot lines.
Now, when you mentioned he was an attorney in a similar position to what you had, so I imagine that your experience winds its way through the novels.
Oh, yes, there's no doubt about it, yes. Not only my experience with the New York City Department of Education, but also with my experience abroad.
Now, in the first book where you had the action moving from country to country, had you been in all those places prior to that?
Yes, although I did make specific trips just for the purposes of fleshing out the novel. And in other words, there was a point when I was writing the novel, I said, gee, I'd like to take it from Paris to Sarajevo. But in order for me to do that and to do it right, I actually went over to Sarajevo for 4 days.
Wow.
And the same thing with Marseille. I went back to Marseille twice to work on this. That's why that novel took me 2 years.
By the way, you were right about the Aquila Memorandum. That was George Siegel. It was also Alec Guinness, Max, and Max Van Snyder.
Yes, I remember Alec Guinness as his control. Yeah, it was very dry. You see, I liked Adam Hall, and I liked Len Dayton, And I liked Jean-Luc Carré because their protagonists all had very cynical points of view towards their careers and their agencies and society at large. And I just found it very enjoyable, and I hate to say it, but it probably matched my own internal viewpoint.
I wonder whether that vantage point, even the Saint novels, they're like that. He's got the cynicism about the line between good and evil, and about who are really bad people and who are honorable crooks. I wonder whether that's very European.
I don't know, but it's certainly very British, and actually carries over because my good friend Kenny Brune, who writes the Jack Taylor novels, he also did a series of Sergeant Brant novels set in London, where Brant is a real off the wall rogue, and everything there is very cynical. As a matter of fact, my novel that I'm working on right now, my current project, takes place in London.
So it won't be a continuation of the Doherty books then.
In a way, it is. It's Doherty in New York, and Hank in London. The protagonist Doherty, but he's no longer the main character. Although he's not minor, but he's not the main character. His sidekick Hank is now the main character.
That's similar to just the idea of Psyche becoming the main character to some of the Tom Clancy books where they spun off one of the characters, and he was the main character in one or two of the books.
Right, right, the Willem Dafoe character.
Right.
Yeah, yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
So, do you have any timetable for the new book?
God, if I had any decency, I'd be finishing it up in the next 2 months. And I should be. I know for some reason I've been procrastinating, but that's the life of a writer.
Now, what venue are you looking to publish it through? Your own, or are you going traditional publisher, or what's your?
It all depends. I may go through a traditional publisher, but I may do it in England first, in Britain first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Do you have contacts there?
Yes, I do.
That's terrific. That's terrific.
Yeah.
And what about short stories? Are you able to do both at the same time, both the novel and get short stories out?
I have four short stories that have been contracted for. I'm just waiting for them to be published this year.
Oh, and on what publications?
All four in the Sherlock Holmes Mystery Magazines.
Terrific.
Yeah. Terrific. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
So we've covered a whole lot. Is there anything else that you'd like the audience to know about you?
No, just check out my website, stantrabolsky.com, and you'll get to read my blog and learn more about my novels. And just stay tuned. I think they'll find a very enjoyable Mean Streets read.
I like the blog very much. Now, for our audience who, as I did, came from an Irish Catholic neighborhood, you might want to spell the blog out for them.
Sure, it's. Well, it's MEANSTREETS, and that's on stantrabolsky.com. Should I spell that?
Yes, please.
Okay, it's stantrabolsky.com.
Terrific.
By the way, I don't know if you or your readers, if you guys follow Downton Abbey at all.
My wife does.
Very interesting. It's the only place in the world where you find six Irish women that are not within walking distance of a Catholic church. the writer's missing something when he writes about the working the servant class there.
Do you miss the Do you miss the legal profession at all? Do you miss the trial work at all?
Not at all. I don't care if I ever see another courtroom again in my life.
That's interesting because I have a whole – there are so many lawyers who have moved into writing and obviously the well-known ones, and many of them seem to never look back. The same for doctors like Michael Crichton and that to leave the medical profession to become writers.
Yeah, well, that's something. I guess it's a question of I imagine Michael Crichton, like myself, just felt he had to do it.
Yeah.
He's one of the lucky ones. Listen, for every writer that makes a living, there's a thousand that don't.
Absolutely, and you're completely correct that most of us write because we have to. I write my columns because I know things that I want other people to know. I write stories because I like to tell a story, and my poetry I write for myself because it helps me learn more about me. So in a lot of ways, they all start with I before they get out. I hope that people like my poetry, for instance, but I really don't care if they do or not.
There you go. Right. If you start caring about that, then it's all over.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been very enjoyable, and I hope to run into you either at another book fair that we'll do or on the phone again.
By the way, I do write poetry as well.
Have you published any?
Not in years, but I recently sent off a poem to the Vatican. Believe
Did
it
you?
Or not, for their publication, I'm waiting to hear back.
I was an English major, and I was away from poetry for 30, 40 years. I didn't want to ever see another poem, and then I was walking through the Barnes & Noble that I hang out, and I saw a book. And I picked it up by the crazy writer, and I said, "Hey, this is good." And then I wrote a poem which someone said I should do something with, so I sent it into a contest, and I forgot about it. And then I won fourth place in the contest, and that ruined everything because then I just wrote and published an anthology of over 100 poems. So it's been fun. And it's been good talking to you, and maybe we can do another book fair soon.
Oh, sure. Same here. I'm looking forward to it. At Coogan's?
Yeah, hopefully. I want to talk to them about doing one during the summer.
Hey, great. You can just count me in, John.
Okay. Be well, and thanks again.
Okay.
The words of Met Rader announced, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with poet Amy Holman. And till then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.